This is the RTE News at 1 with Brian Dobson. Good afternoon. The headlines this Friday lunchtime. The Public Prosecution Service for Northern Ireland has decided not to prosecute 15 British soldiers in relation to allegations of false evidence to the Bloody Sunday inquiry. The High Court in Dublin has approved a settlement for dozens of families who sued a chain of creches over alleged treatment of their children. And world leaders have renewed their calls on Israel and Iran to step back from the brink following a missile attack on an Iranian army base overnight. The news in detail with Susan Jackson.
None of the British soldiers who gave evidence to the Bloody Sunday inquiry will face perjury charges over their testimony to the tribunal. 15 were investigated after the judge leading the public inquiry said soldiers had lied while giving evidence. Our Northern correspondent, Conor McCauley.
The public inquiry, which exonerated the victims of Bloody Sunday, said some soldiers had presented knowingly false accounts to justify opening fire on the civil rights marchers that day. 13 unarmed civilians were killed in Derry in 1972. 15 soldiers were investigated for perjury over their evidence to the inquiry. Today, the Public Prosecution Service said none would face charges. Neither would an alleged member of the official IRA, who was also reported for the offence of perjury. Prosecutors said the availability and admissibility of evidence was insufficient to support the reasonable prospect of a conviction in any of the 16 cases. The families of the Bloody Sunday dead expressed disappointment and suggested that further legal action might be on the cards. One of the soldiers considered on a perjury charge is Soldier F, who's currently being prosecuted for 2 counts of murder and 4 attempted murders on Bloody Sunday. The Public Prosecution Service said the decision not to charge him with perjury would have no impact on the more serious charges he continues to face. Conor McCauley, RT News, Belfast.
The High Court in Dublin has approved a settlement for dozens of families who sued a chain of creches over alleged treatment of their children. Each of the 41 families settled their cases for €15,000, bringing the total sum awarded to €615,000. The settlement was reached after mediation and there was no admission of liability by hide-and-seek childcare. The suit was brought by parents on behalf of their children against the creche owners, Anne and Peter Davey, and their daughter Siobhan. The case arose following the broadcast in 2019 of an RTE Investigates report, Creches Behind Closed Doors. European and other world leaders have pledged to redouble their efforts to prevent an escalation of the conflict in the Middle East. Overnight, officials in the US, Israel and Iran reported explosions in Isfahan in central Iran. However, official confirmation of the exact details of the blasts have been slow. According to unnamed officials quoted in media reports, Israel launched the attack, but Iranian state media appears to be playing down the import of the incident. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said a reduction in tension in the Middle East was in the best interests of the region and the rest of the world.
To do everything possible that all sides restrain from the escalation in that region. We have seen the massive attack with drones and missiles, around about 300, by Iran on Israel. It is absolutely necessary that the region stays stable and that all sides refrain from further action.
At a meeting of G7 foreign ministers on the Italian island of Capri, the Italian foreign minister Antonio Tajani said a reduction in hostilities in the region should be the overarching objective. He also spoke about what the G7 wanted to see happen in Gaza.
We have reiterated our commitment towards an immediate and sustainable ceasefire in order to ensure the release of the hostages and also to ensure the provision of goods and food to the Palestinian civil population.
The foreign ministers also discussed the Russian war in Ukraine. They expressed strong concern about transfers of dual-use materials and weapons components from Chinese businesses to Russia for use in Russia's military expansion. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged other foreign ministers to increase pressure on China to stop helping Russia's most ambitious defense expansion since the Soviet era.
If China purports, on the one hand, to want good relations with Europe and other countries, it can't, on the other hand, be fueling what is the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Cold War. And you don't have to just take that from me. This is what I heard around the table at the G7.
And now the weather.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Grant. Create a modern, minimalistic home decor look and warmth in every room with Grant Uflex underfloor heating. Visit grant.ie.
It'll be cloudy at first this afternoon. There'll be patches of light rain or drizzle, mainly in the northeast and east. However, the cloud will gradually break up during the day, giving way to sunny spells. Highest temperatures will range from 11 to 15 degrees. Brian.
Thank you, Susan. Still to come this lunchtime, Israel retaliates drone attacks on Iran overnight as the EU calls for restraint, saying the war in Gaza must not be allowed to spread. The Stardust inquest, Sathishek says he'll meet the families tomorrow to discuss the state's response to the finding of unlawful killing. Russian missile attack in eastern Ukraine leaves 8 dead, including 2 children, as Ukraine braces itself for an expected Russian offensive. And the European Commission suggests easing post-Brexit travel restrictions for young British people.
Whatever you watch, wherever you watch it, if you watch it on a TV, you must have a TV licence. It's the law. Get yours at tvlicense.ie or any post office. Brought to you by the Government of Ireland.
Go full family dinners on Lidl Plus. Mix and match any 3 of these quality Irish meats for just €9. Pick up chicken dinner winners, add bulky beef-filled meals, and explore even more meaty mains like pork belly strips and turkey burgers. Go on, mix and match any 3 for €9. Scan the Lidl Plus app and go full Lidl today.
Hello again. You're listening to the news at 1. Foreign ministers of the G7 group of leading industrial nations meeting in Capri in Italy have urged all parties to work to prevent further escalation in the Middle East after drone attacks on Iran overnight, widely regarded as the work of Israel. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, has called on countries in the region to show maximum restraint. In a message on social media at the conclusion of the G7 meeting, Mr. Borrell said, "We have to stop the war in Gaza and avoid it expanding to the rest of the region." According to US officials, Israel struck a military facility in central Iran last night. The attack, apparently in retaliation for Iran's drone and missile strike on Israel last weekend, didn't cause any significant damage, with Iran downplaying its impact. Asked about the attack, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he's not going to speak to reported events, but he said the US had not been involved in any offensive operations.
The United States has not been involved in any offensive operations. What we're focused on, what the G7 is focused on, and again, it's reflected in our statement and in our conversation, is our work to de-escalate tensions, to de-escalate from any potential conflict. You saw Israel on the receiving end of an unprecedented attack, but our focus has been on, of course, making sure that Israel can effectively defend itself, but also de-escalating tensions, avoiding conflict, and that remains our focus.
US Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Let's talk now to Middle East analyst with the BBC, Sebastian Usher, who's on the line. A very good afternoon to you, Sebastian, and thanks for taking our call this afternoon. This apparent drone attack was on an area in which there's a concentration of Iranian nuclear facilities and military installations. What at this stage is known about what happened?
It's still not entirely clear. I mean, the reason for that is that the main source we have is the Iranian state media. And as you said in my introduction, it's really played down this incident quite strongly. Even the president, President Raisi, the Iranian president, was actually speaking since this attack happened, and he didn't actually mention it. And on the other side, the Israeli side, as is their wont, the Israeli government government hasn't given any public confirmation of what happened. I think there's no doubt that this was a strike carried out by Israel. We had, again, as you were saying, off the record in terms of who the officials are, but US officials saying that it was Israel, and also the Italian foreign minister at the G7 saying that the US had informed the ministers there that the US did get some forewarning from Israel last minute that this attack was going to happen. As you say, where it happened, it seems to be over Isfahan, which is where there's quite a large number of military industrial facilities. It includes an important facility in Iran's nuclear program. It's also where there's an airbase which hosts F-14s that Iran has. That may well be what the target was, and it may well be that the message that Israel was sending is that, yes, this is a limited attack. It's not meant to cause casualties, not meant to cause major damage, but we know where these facilities are, and we can hit them if we want to.
Now, the Iranian government had warned that any further action by Israel would elicit a response from the regime in Tehran, but if they're playing this down, does that mean that it might be possible to say these exchanges, this tit-for-tat, these tit-for-tat attacks could be over?
I think it's a little bit early to say that. I think what we can say with some confidence is that this isn't an escalation, but it would only really be if the Iranian authorities decided that they wanted to take it another step higher. What Iran was reacting to last week when it launches unprecedented strike on Israel, hundreds of drones, 300 drones and missiles, none of which caused any casualties or any major damage, then I think that was baked into the attack from the start because of Israel's defensive system, because of the work by its allies, the US, the UK, etc. But it was in response what Iran did to an attack before that, which again Israel didn't claim responsibility for, but everyone pretty much believes and knows that it was Israel, on its consulate in Damascus, with two senior generals being killed. I think that what has happened overnight would not be regarded by Tehran as on that level. So Iran, even less than Israel, wants to go into an all-out confrontation. So it would be a surprise if Iran used this as an opportunity to escalate further.
We know that after the successful repelling of the Iranian missiles over the weekend, Sebastian, President Biden had urged the Israelis to quote, take the win. Does it look like that US influence has borne fruit?
I think it does. I mean, I think the Netanyahu government hasn't been listening to the US as it's increased its criticism of the military strategy and the civilian casualties in Gaza. But it has listened to the US over this issue at the moment. And that may be because, as things are, it's not in the Israeli government, in Netanyahu's interests, to take Iran on fully right now. I mean, one can't rule that out. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has for years been saying that this is essential. He has been calling for the strongest possible international effort against Iran, including attacks. So I don't think we can rule that out entirely. But for now, it doesn't seem to be what he's after. There is speculation, and we have heard this again from unnamed US officials, that this may be some kind of a quid pro quo. The US has been very, very strongly calling on the Israeli government not to pursue a major military operation into the southernmost town of Rafah in Gaza, where more than a million displaced Palestinians are now living. The Israeli government, Netanyahu, its military, has said it's essential in order to achieve its aim of eradicating Hamas completely. That's what it must do. It may be that that the US has got Israel to rein itself in on this level in the confrontation with Iran, but that may be a payoff in terms of giving more free rein to Israel in Rafah.
And if the US is exerting pressure on Israel, is there any outside party exerting pressure on the Iranians?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, we have heard from Russia, which is close to Iran, calling for a de-escalation as well, although putting the real responsibility of this on Israel, as you would expect. I think Iran, as I've said, doesn't really have a real gain in the end to take Israel on directly. It's managed to avoid that for years. The shadow war that everyone talks about that the two countries have essentially been fighting has suited Iran to an extent, because Iran has its strength in its proxies around the region. Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Houthis in Yemen, there are militias in Iraq, and so on and so forth. And it's accomplished quite a lot in terms of being able to push its agenda in the Middle East through that, which doesn't take up a huge amount. It does. It's expensive, but it doesn't take up a massive amount of its finances, which are in a very bad state. And it doesn't commit its military. And Iran's military is not anywhere near the strength of Israel. So in a direct confrontation, Iran would be the loser.
Very good. We'll leave it there. Sebastian, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us. That's Sebastian Usher there from the BBC. Here, the Taoiseach has said he hopes to meet the families of those who died in the Stardust fire tomorrow, following yesterday's inquest verdicts that the 48 young people had perished as a result of unlawful killing. Simon Harris said he wants to be in a position to apologise to the families on behalf of the country, but is keen to hear what they have to say.
I've reached out to the families today, the Stardust families, and I've offered to meet them tomorrow. I'm very keen to meet with the families. I'm very conscious that these families have felt unheard for decades, and I want to make sure that they know that I'm listening and that I want to hear them. And of course I want to be in a position as Taoiseach to apologise on behalf of this country. But I think the most appropriate thing to do is to seek to meet with them. I did speak to Antoinette Keegan yesterday evening from Brussels, and I've reached out today to offer to meet the families tomorrow, if that works for them, or if not, at another time of their choosing. But I am eager to be in a position to apologise to these families, but I think it's right and proper that I would meet them first, and I hope that that can take place tomorrow.
Do you think there will be further investigations into Stardust, particularly criminal investigation, possibly?
Well, I think it's very important that as Taoiseach, I'm careful what I say in relation to that. There's a number of processes in different parts of the state that I think we'll need to consider the outcome of the coroner's inquest yesterday. I am aware that, of course, the Gardaí will be reviewing the coroner's report. That's right and proper that they do, and that obviously happens independent of government and of the political system. I'm also conscious that my colleague, the Minister for Justice, will ask the Attorney General to consider the report from the coroner as well, the outcome of the inquest. But as Taoiseach, I feel very strongly that it is important that the state recognises the pain, the suffering, the trauma, and the appallingly long time these families have had to work, campaign, and in many cases fight for truth and justice. But I think it's really important that I meet with them first, and I don't just talk to them, but that I listen to them. And I'm hoping to be in a position that I'm hoping that they will be in a position to do that tomorrow.
Taoiseach Simon Harris speaking there to our Southeast correspondent Conor Kane in Carlow this morning. Well, Samantha Kern was just 4 years old when her mother, Helena Mangan, died in the Stardust fire. Helena was just 22 years old at the time. Samantha told Carol Coleman how she felt about the prospect of a state apology.
Well, one, it's a well overdue apology, but at the end of the day, this should have been sorted years ago. You know what I mean? We shouldn't be at this state. You know that they're looking to apologise to us. You know, this should have been. We shouldn't have had to go through this and make them guilt them into doing some sort of apologies to apologise. 43 years later, it's a bit overdue in my eyes. You know.
So, are you saying that for yourself, perhaps that an apology would be very hollow?
Apology is great, but it's just well overdue, you know, at the end of the day. I just feel personally myself, I shouldn't have been here fighting for my mum. I was only four. I'll accept the apology, but it's, to me, I just feel it's long overdue. And is it going to be really heartfelt from them? Is it just words? And the way I feel, it's probably just words just to say, to save face. And my mammy was my whole world. She was a single mother, you know what I mean? She was my everything. And to grow up without having her there was heartbreaking for me. And a part of me is broken and will never be fixed. No matter what anybody says or does, they're not going to fix the loss of me not having my mother there for my first day of school, my confirmation, my wedding, when I had my kids. There's no apology that's going to bring back my mum to me.
And how do your own children process all of this now?
they're delighted for what's happened, but like they're all still quite young, so they don't really know the full effect of this has all, you know what I mean? They're still quite young and they've missed out on having, to me, what would have been the best nanny in the world, you know? They didn't get a chance to meet her, they didn't get a chance to cuddle her, you know what I mean? They're never going to have my mum as their grandmother, never, you know? They've missed out on having that role model that everybody should have in their life, a mother and a grandmother, you know, and they didn't have a grandmother.
And that's Samantha Curran speaking there to our reporter, Carol Coleman. Well, let's talk to our political correspondent, Tommy Mescal, who joins us now from our Oireachtas studio. So, Tommy, the Taoiseach offering to meet the Stardust families tomorrow, is the main item on the agenda the possibility of a state apology of some sort?
I think the government, Brian, is very much minded to provide this state apology if possible. After yesterday's verdict, the three coalition leaders held discussions to decide on what the government's response would be. And as you heard earlier on there, the Taoiseach Simon Harris this morning talking about the need to acknowledge the pain, suffering and trauma that these families have experienced over the past four decades. There is, I understand, plans to have Dáil's statements on Tuesday in relation to the Stardust tragedy. As to whether that could be a forum that would facilitate that state apology, that's not yet clear. It may come too soon, given that the coroner's report has to be completed, but also that has to be considered by the Attorney General. So as to whether the Taoiseach would be in a position to provide that state apology on Tuesday isn't yet clear, but we do know the direction of travel. The government is minded to facilitate that apology, but a number of processes have yet to play out.
Right. Separately, Tommy, the Taoiseach also commented today on a protest that took place at the home of the Minister of Integration, Roderick O'Gorman.
That's right, Brian. This happened yesterday. A number of masked individuals gathered outside the home of Minister for Integration, Roderick O'Gorman, and a number of banners were erected outside the house as well. This provoked a reaction on social media. You saw a lot of people, including opposition politicians, expressing their solidarity with Roderick O'Gorman. And Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, was asked about this earlier when he was speaking to reporters. He said that the sight of masked people outside the home of Roderick O'Gorman, but indeed any individual, whether they're a public person or a private person, was chilling and quite frankly disgusting, he said. A number of questions were put to him about the Garda response as to whether this incident should have been prevented from happening, whether the demonstration should have been prevented from happening. Simon Harris said that he understood the difficulties in policing such situations. However, he did say that he was going to speak with the Gardaí at the earliest opportunity. The Minister for Justice, Brian Helen McEntee, has also tweeted in the past short while, a very short statement. She described what happened as disgusting and shocking as well. And she also said that she has spoken to the Garda Commissioner about this incident. She finishes the short statement by saying that such incidents cannot be tolerated.
Tommy Mescal, political correspondent, thanks very much for that. Two Russian strikes in Ukraine's central Dnipropetrovsk region have killed eight people, including two children, according to officials in Ukraine. The station in the main city of Dnipro came under attack and several homes were hit. Earlier this week, the northern Ukrainian city of Chernihiv was struck in Russia's deadliest attack for some time, leaving 18 people dead and dozens wounded. Let's talk to Christopher Miller now, Financial Times correspondent in Ukraine. Thanks once again for taking our call, Christopher. First of all, what do we know about this latest attack in Dnipro?
Well, as you mentioned, it was merely the latest Russian airstrike in Ukraine and on one of its most populous cities. The city of Dnipro is a strategic industrial city of roughly a million people, and it's the largest city closest to the front line out there in the southeast of the region. So it's a very important city. At least eight people died today, with dozens more injured, and there was serious destruction to some of the centrally located buildings. And this was, again, just one of the many airstrikes that Russia has carried out recently. You mentioned the attack on Chernihiv, just about an hour north of me, or 2 hours north of me, from where I am in Kiev right now. And this was a really devastating attack where 18 people were killed. And this city has come under increasing bombardment as Russia presses its air assault on the country.
And there is now a widespread expectation, and you've been reporting on this in Ukraine, there in Kiev, that there will be a spring-summer offensive mounted by the Russians.
That's right. The Ukrainians are warning that Russia is bearing down on its forces in the east and the southeast, and that they're possibly preparing to launch a larger scale offensive in the summer. You know, what it's doing right now with these airstrikes is sort of softening the battlefield for its ground forces to press ahead if it manages a breakthrough in the south and the east. And what we're seeing with these airstrikes also is the Ukrainians' air defense weaknesses. Russia is exploiting those right now because the United States Congress has yet to pass this critical $60 billion aid package to replenish Ukraine's air defense systems and munitions. So this is all part of what is a very difficult situation that Ukraine is in at the moment, and is, of course, watching very closely what Russia is doing on the ground as well as in the air.
And how important is it that U.S. aid would be unlocked? There have been moves in the U.S. Congress in recent days to try to get that aid package through. How vital is that for Ukraine?
It's absolutely critical. Ukraine relies heavily, if not almost completely, on the United States for military assistance. Europe is providing some things. We saw the Germans have announced a new air defense Patriot missile system for Ukraine, but this is only going to cover a small portion of the country. So this American assistance is vital for Ukraine to be able to defend itself in the air, on the ground. And if it doesn't come, these soldiers who I visited on the Eastern Front just last week will have no artillery shells to defend themselves with. And the concern there is that Russian forces will be able to push deeper and deeper into the country.
And when you visited the front line and spoke to those Ukrainian troops, what did you see and what did you hear about the preparations that they're making, Christopher?
Yeah, they are digging in deep. There are new trenches being dug. There are what's called dragon's teeth, or these concrete fortifications that are meant to stop tracked vehicles from advancing further into the country. They're erecting these new fortifications in preparation for what is expected to be another Russian offensive in the next couple of months. You know, morale has fallen some. The Ukrainians are concerned about the lack of military assistance from the West, and obviously the Russians bearing down on them further. It was a tough fight out there. There was hardly a minute that went by without an explosion. There are airstrikes and these really devastating glide bombs that the Russian Air Force is using now to pound their way through Ukraine's front lines. It's a really difficult situation that the Ukrainians are in.
And at this stage, from the description that you've given, this is about Ukraine trying to defend the territory that it still holds. Talk of an offensive to try to recapture territory from the Russians, that's a distant memory?
It's a distant memory, and I think, you know, the next Ukrainian counteroffensive is you know, somewhere in the far future. You know, nobody is talking about a Ukrainian offensive at the moment. What Ukraine is focused on is digging in. This is being talked about as a year of defense. The goal now is mainly to stop Russia's advances deeper into the country and to stockpile weapons, to get more assistance from the West, and really for Ukraine to replenish its forces, to build up its stocks, and to put it in a better position for when it is ready, eventually, hopefully, down the line, to launch another counteroffensive to retake this territory that Russia occupies.
Christopher Miller of the Financial Times in Kyiv, thanks so much for that. Is Brussels planning to grant the benefits of free movement across the EU to young Britons despite Brexit? Well, it's reported that the European Commission may open talks with the UK on visa-free exchanges and free movement for younger people. Lisa O'Carroll of the Guardian's Brussels office, their correspondent there, has the story. So what's being talked about there, Lisa?
Yes, Brian, good afternoon. What the EU Commission said yesterday was that they had recommended that negotiations on this very subject open with the UK. It caught everybody by surprise. We were in the middle of an EU leader summit. It has been a subject, however, youth mobility, that the UK, including some Tories, have been pushing quite strongly on since Brexit. In a way, you know, seen as a bit of having your cake and eat it. Yes, we will leave the EU. Yes, we will cut our ties, including the benefits with which the single market brings, mm-hmm. such as free movement. But we want it back for our youth. We want the EU citizens, young people, back for our cafes, our restaurants, our hotels. So that's what happened yesterday. It has to go to the leaders or to a council, possibly in May, where the European member states will decide whether it's a go or not, and then negotiations may open.
And of course, it would have to work both ways. There'd be freedom of movement for young British people. I think the suggestion would be it would be those on under 30, but to go into the EU. But there'd also presumably then have to be reciprocal arrangements by the UK for EU, young EU citizens.
Yes, it's absolutely reciprocal. So it's both ways. And I think I know from London that the foreign minister there has said that it has been the collapse of youth exchanges, collapse of school trips, etc., has been like the number one issue that he is raised when he goes to European capitals. Maybe, you know, this is maybe a year ago. But what's interesting this morning is that Downing Street has completely pushed back against this. There's obviously a sense of panic that the Brexiter backbenchers, the Brexiter groups within politics in Britain are still very strong, that any suggestion that there would be anything like, and this is not free movement, it's limited movement, but it nonetheless allows students to work, to study, etc., for up to 4 years, that is a kind of opening the door to return to EU.
Yeah.
So Downing Street pushed back on it, and the Labour Party have said nothing.
Well, one wonders exactly, Lisa, whether this is an offer that's directed not at the current Rishi Sunak-led Tory government, but at the next one, presumably when Keir Starmer will be in Downing Street.
Indeed, but it is difficult because there are so many politicians and so many people who think this is a really, really good thing. The UK have been banging on about how France has it with Canada, Australia has it with the UK, and indeed Ireland, where you can get a limited visa to work for a number of seasons in Australia. So there's lots of support for it, but politically, at the high level, that Brexiter group still counts in British politics.
Before I let you go, Lisa, we were talking earlier about the latest developments with regard to what's been happening in Israel and Iran, and indeed in Gaza as well. Some discussion within the EU about revisiting sanctions on Iran. Is that something that's getting traction?
Yes, we've had a number of briefings on that this morning. There's a key meeting of foreign ministers and defence ministers in Luxembourg on Monday. They're talking about extending existing Russian and Iranian sanctions on drones and sanctioning those proxies that are involved in their manufacture, and also sanctions on missiles. However, legally, it's hypothetical now because they don't have the legal right to do it. There's a court case going on in Germany which may provide them with the legal comfort. Everybody admits this is all about sending a strong message to Iran. However, there are some member states who think it's not a good idea because it would close down a channel of communication with Iran.
All right. We'll leave it there. Lisa O'Carroll from The Guardian in Brussels, thanks very much for that. Back with more after this short break.
Wake up to mattress and bed savings at the Harvey Norman 5-Day Mattress Sale. With huge savings of up to 40% on the biggest brands like Sealy Posturepedic, Sleep Easy, Silent Night, King Coil, Thermapure and the Briady Spa Collection. Plus, get free delivery, free removal and recycling of your old mattress. And with up to 36 months interest-free finance available, why wait? The Harvey Norman 5-Day Mattress Sale now on. But hurry, must end Monday.
RTE Radio 1.
Paolo Nutini. Live. Comond Park, Limerick, on Saturday the 13th of July. His only Irish show in 2024. With very special guest, C-Mat. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster.ie. Subject to license. Paolo Nutini. Live at Comond Park. Tickets available now.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Hello again, you're listening to the news at 1. 41 families who sued the hide-and-seek creche company in North Dublin over what were described as damning standards at the group in 2019 have settled their cases for €15,000 each in the High Court. The actions were taken against the creche owners following an RT Investigates programme 5 years ago, which uncovered a lapse in standards of care across the company's four creches at the time. Our reporter Dimitri O'Donnell was in Cork. Dimitri, first of all, you might just remind us a little more of the background to this case.
That's right, Brian. As you outlined there, these 41 cases arose out of the RTÉ Investigates programme in 2019. That's when a team went undercover to expose a lapse of standards in the family-run preschool, which has four facilities in North Dublin, and they're owned by the Davy family. Now, RTÉ Investigates revealed during that investigation that there was a breach of regulations, including child-to-adult ratios, and there was a failure by the company to keep records. Up to 20 children were left with one care worker during a period of time during that programme revealed. Some of the other issues observed by the Investigates team included the failure of hide-and-seek management to ensure that staff were guard-the-vetted before working with children, and this is a TUSLA-mandated requirement, and that did not happen. And it is worth pointing out that the senior counsel for the families repeatedly said that these breaches were dating back 5 years and not had no bearing on facilities and the standards run by the creche today.
What did lawyers for the parents have to say?
Well, the 41 children who were in the four creches were said to be very, I think, traumatised was the word that was used. And the parents noted that when they were taken home, their progress seemed to go backwards and they wondered what was going on. Now, the children were said to be hungry when they also came home because of the poor quality of the food they received at the creche, according to the senior counsel, Mr. Gordon. The High Court was also told that the children endured these alleged overcrowded conditions and that many of the staff were poorly trained and that had an impact on their children. So in each of the 41 cases, the parents paid for their own assessment. They went to a psychologist and the court was told that those fees would be repaid in full on top of the €15,000 that they would be receiving. Mr. Justice Coffey was told that all the children had a similar experience, which was traumatic at the time. However, he was told that because the children were very young, they were pre-verbal, they were sufficiently resilient to get over it, and over time they should make a full recovery. It is worth pointing out as well that the family who owns Hide and Seek had no admission of liability when this settlement was awarded, which was the maximum under judicial guidelines.
Dimitri O'Donnell in the High Court, thank you for that. The Football Association of Ireland has said it does not now expect to appoint a new manager to the men's senior team until September. It's hoping to extend interim manager John O'Shea's spell in charge, but has yet to reach agreement with the former Manchester United player to take the helm for June's two international friendlies. It all comes just a few days after it was announced that Jonathan Hill is to leave his post as chief executive of the FAI at the end of this month. Let's talk about this now to our soccer correspondent, Tony O'Donoghue. So the promises of a manager by the end of April, that's gone the way of the summer so far, would seem, Tony.
Oh, listen, this has become high farce at this stage. I'm sure they'll be doing musicals and plays about this. We were told that they'd expect a manager by the draw for the Nations League on the 8th of February. That deadline passed, but there was no panic because then we were told in March that the appointment would be made in early April, but that they couldn't announce it then due to existing contractual obligations. John O'Shea took charge of the team for two games against Belgium and Switzerland and built a support staff around him for that. But it was being made clear this was his first time ever picking a team and he wasn't going to be the man to take Ireland forward. But the process has not concluded. And today, the director of football, Mark Hannan, more or less held his hands up, apologised for the expectation that all the speculation had caused, saying that that was probably shows how much people care about this job. But it is extraordinary now. We're expecting that there won't be a full-time new Republic of Ireland manager in place until the next competitive fixture. That's against England in September. In the meantime, we'll have two games against Hungary and Portugal in June.
And Tony, is it possible to say how much of this is a result of the controversy that's surrounded Jonathan Hill in recent months?
Jonathan Hill was part of the process. They say that process is not concluded. There's a sense that Jonathan Hill, who's only left his office this week, was hoping to have the Irish manager as one of his achievements as he was leaving the organisation, along with, of course, getting a new sponsor for the men's team, and he took credit for the growth in the women's game. But that wasn't concluded in time for that. And now it's interesting that I note that Paul Cook, the president of the Football Association, whose comments in the Oireachtas probably hastened the exit of Jonathan Hill, he's now been added to the role of honour of the people entrusted with finding the new manager. Paul Cook is the president, Paddy Bonner is a board member now, a former legendary Ireland goalkeeper, of course, and David Carell, the interim manager, along with Mark Canham. Mark Canham is basically telling us to trust the process. He said the criteria for the type of head coach they're looking for is someone who can improve the team and make us competitive with a good mix of club and international experience. So that's not John O'Shea. And the coaches they've spoken to so far, they've spoken to ones who are available, others with existing contractual obligations. So they want the right coach that makes the right fit for the team and with the right timing. And that the timing now is going to be September, which is extraordinary.
Well, September is when the next competitive fixtures in the Nations League, isn't that right?
That's
take
correct.
Place. But presumably any incoming manager would want to be in place quite some time before that to prepare for those fixtures.
Well, in truth, an incoming manager should be looking at the players now as the Premier League and Championship seasons come to a close, assessing the fitness of players. Mm-hmm. I note that Gavin Bazunu, our number one goalkeeper, is going to be out for 10 months now, it seems, with an injury. So Caoimhín Kelleher perhaps gets that gig. But a manager needs to be looking at players all the time, assessing their potential and trying to build his squad for what we hope will be a competitive Nations League campaign.
All right. Tony O'Donoghue, soccer correspondent, thanks so much for that.
Sport on RTE Radio 1.
And with more of today's sport, here's Andrew O'Connor. Andrew.
Thank you, Brian. As you just heard, the FAI Director of Football, Mark Canham, has apologised to Republic of Ireland supporters for the delay in appointing a new manager to the men's senior team, as he revealed he does not expect an appointment now until September. The FAI are now hoping to extend interim manager John O'Shea's spell in charge, but Canham admitted they have yet to reach an agreement with the former Manchester United player to take charge for June's two international friendlies. The process of replacing Stephen Kenny, who departed in November, had already been a prolonged one, with the FAI promising that the job would be filled on a permanent basis in early April. With that self-imposed deadline now having well passed, and the FAI still seemingly far away from an appointment, unrest among supporters is very much growing. Republic of Ireland and Southampton goalkeeper Gavin Bazunu will be sidelined for 9 to 10 months after it was confirmed that he suffered a ruptured Achilles tendon. Bazunu hobbled out of the warm-up session prior to Southampton's 3-0 championship win over Preston North End during the week. In the SSE Airtricity Premier Division tonight, leaders Shelburne are away to Galway United. Second place Derry City host champions Shamrock Rovers, a game that's live on RT2 television this evening with coverage beginning at 7:35. Third place Bohemians entertain Drogheda United. Sligo Rovers play Dundalk and St Patrick's Athletic face Waterford FC. Kick-off in all of the games tonight in the Premier Division is at 7:45. In rugby, Charlie Entai returns to the Leinster team to take on the Lions tomorrow in the BKT United Rugby Championship in South Africa. The versatile back has recovered from a long-standing calf injury. The number 12 jersey goes to Liam Turner, with Kieran Frawley starting again at fullback, while Rob Russell and Andrew Osborne man the wings. Luke McGrath and Harry Byrne are the halfbacks. Calvin Nash and RG Snyman are among six Munster changes for their championship clash with the Bulls on tomorrow afternoon. Nash, Shane Daly and Snyman start, having missed out on the Champions Cup loss to Northampton 2 weeks ago due to injury and illness, with Conor Murray, Alex Kindellan and Jack O'Donoghue also coming into the starting 15. Simon Zeebo moves to fullback, with Nash and Daly starting on either wing. In golf, Seamus Powers tied for second place going into the second round of the Heritage event in South Carolina. On 600 par, he's just two shots behind the leader, JT Poston of the United States of America. Rory McIlroy, 4 under par, and Shane Lowry will start on 1 under. Stephanie Meadow holds a share of 18th place on 1 under par ahead of day 2 of the Chevron Championship in Texas. That's the first major of the women's golf season. She's 5 strokes off the lead. Leona Maguire is a shot further back on level par. And finally, at day 2 of the European Boxing Championships in Belgrade in Serbia, flyweight Ricky Nesbitt is the only Irish boxer in action today. He meets Turkey's Samet Gumus in the preliminary round. The sports news anytime on the RT.